Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your host, and today we are delighted to have with us a long overdue interview with Sheldon George discussing his book, Trauma and Race, a Lacanian Study of African-American Racial Identity, and my earbud just fell out of my ear. That was interesting. Okay, there we go. Sheldon is the chair of the Department of English at Simmons College in Boston, where he teaches on African-American literature and culture and literary theory. This book that we're going to be discussing today was published in 2016 by Baylor University Press and forthcoming also, and we'll talk more about this during the interview, Sheldon and Derek Cook have a book coming out called titled Lacan and Race and will be published by Routledge. So, without further ado, but it's long overdue, I've been really wanting to interview you. I'd like to welcome you, Sheldon, to New Books in Psychoanalysis.
Thank you very much. We've been planning this for a while. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great that we finally made it. I wanted to ask you the question that I ask everyone, which is that to the degree you can understand your own motivations, what motivated the writing of this particular text?
I think at the time I was reading a lot of African American scholars who seemed to take seriously and truly believe in the concept of race, which to me seems really problematic. To me, race is grounded in fantasy. And I was reading people like Lucius Outlaw, who seemed so attached to race that, you know, his arguments seemed to defy logic. And I was trying to understand what's happening here. So part of it was my engagement with the existing scholarship at the time. But part of it, too, was just a reflection of a sort of discord between my sense of race and how I saw others talking about race. So you'll notice that, you know, the fantasy of race is at the center of the text.
Yeah, I'm thinking of your other colleagues like Houston Baker or Henry Louis Gates as well, in talking about the idea of resignification. And in this book, you have some really, as a psychoanalyst, I was very much so convinced by what you argue about what's left out of the resignification project. Would you care to talk about that for us?
Yeah, sure. So I think one component of African-American theories of African-American culture and African-American literature is a focus on resignification. It's this effort to redefine the terms that have defined us. And African-American scholars have tended to see this as a route toward establishing some level of agency. But the problem, the core problem with resignification is that it's focused singularly on the symbolic or the world of language. And so this notion appears in different ways. Henry Louis Gates Jr. talks about a concept that he calls the signifying monkey. And, you know, he's done work on trickster figures, and other African-American scholars have talked about trickster figures and the ways that they play with language and the way that you gain agency through manipulating the meanings of words. And so one example may be, you know, resignification of the N-word. Mm-hmm. There seems to be an effort there to claim the word, to define what defines us. But the problem is that you're only working at the level of the symbolic. And what you miss from a psychoanalytic perspective is the unconscious and what Lacan calls the real. The real being inherently what escapes language. It's the space that trauma occupies. And so part of my analysis is focused on the idea that slavery is a traumatic past that cannot be directly addressed through resignification. It's actually masked through resignification. Part of the argument that I make in the book comes from a reading of Du Bois and also of Frantz Fanon. And what I show through those two figures is the way that resignification becomes an attempt to compensate for trauma. I define trauma as a confrontation with lack, a sort of splitting of the psyche. Lacan talks about trauma as the approach toward a place that you can only encounter through a splitting of the subject. And so there's a splitting of the psyche when you confront something that's traumatic, but we can't stay in that place of trauma. And so what ends up happening is that identity itself becomes an attempt to compensate for trauma. And the implication for me is that African-American identity is caught up in this attempt to compensate for trauma. And one thing that propels this continuous attempt is the belief that we can resignify race. But you're not getting at the real. You don't touch the real. And so, in truth, it's the real that's propelling you and giving you a false sense of agency.
Right. And there's a quote from the book that jumped out at me. For Du Bois, slavery crystallizes his feelings and sense of self in what Lacan calls a, quote, dialectic that has as its center a bad encounter.
Right.
It's palpable and... Go ahead. I'll add on later, maybe, if it comes up.
Yeah, so what happens with Du Bois, I think, is what happens with race in general. That is, the way that Lacan talks about trauma is that trauma has a moment of overt confrontation where you confront this traumatic thing. But then your understanding of what you confront gets displaced onto something else. And so my argument is that what is inherently traumatic in psychoanalytic theory is the splitting of the psyche, which is, in Lacanian theory, it's the root of subjectivity. The psyche is split into what Lacan calls the symbolic, the real, and the imaginary. And that is what constitutes us as subjects. So subjectivity itself is traumatic. And that splitting of subjectivity introduces in us what Lacan calls lack. And I can explain what all of that means in more detail, but to complete the thought, what happens is that this splitting gets displaced. It's not associated with something that has happened in the psyche. It gets associated with a temporal moment. And so Du Bois's own psychological splitting gets pinned to the specific historical moment of slavery. And so there is a conflation of personal trauma, or more precisely, personal psychic structure with historical trauma. And I think this is the root of a lot of other conflations whereby the subject starts to see him or herself in relation to race, which gets rooted to the past of slavery. So that slavery comes to explain one's racial identity, and one's racial identity starts to become the core of one's self.
You know, I'm sure you know this quote from For Colored Girls by Ntozake Shange. I couldn't stand being colored and sorry at the same time.
Right.
It seems so redundant in the modern world.
Right.
And I thought that quote kept coming up as I read the book. I said, I think this is what part of what you're trying to get to encourage people getting up and under and underneath. There's another place to go.
Yes.
Is part of the risk you take in this book. There is an elsewhere. Asking people to give up on their identities, if they're rooted in trauma, usually arouses a lot of resistance.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm sure you've had many conversations.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the lure of race is that, to a certain extent, it is protective, right? The way that I talk about it in the book, especially toward the end of that chapter that's focused on Du Bois and Fanon, is I talk about race as a sort of wound, a scar. And what does a scar do? It protects you, right? It protects from further infestation. But at the same time, it leaves a mark. And the mark that it leaves for African Americans is a sort of sore spot in the symbolic itself. It's a incomplete integration into the larger societal structure. And so within the tapestry of the symbolic, there is this mark, this dark spot that cannot be fully integrated. And so there are a number of metaphors that I use throughout the book, race as a shield. You know, race does have protective qualities. It does have political utility. But the problem is that we get lost in it. And we start to believe that this is me. I'm my race. You know? And from a Lacanian psychoanalytic perspective, Lacan talks about what he calls the ethics of psychoanalysis, and he ties ethics to desire, to the proper functioning of desire. What I see in race is something that diverts desire. Du Bois talks about falling in love with a woman and then dumping her because she's white, because he couldn't take what people were saying on the streets. Frantz Fanon has a patient that he talks about who falls in love with a white woman and dumps her, and says it's because this is a guy named Jean Venus in Frantz Fanon's Black Skin, White Masks. And he says that, he leaves her because she's white. But then Frantz Fanon, working from the position of his analysts, realizes that he leaves the woman because he is what Frantz Fanon calls an abandonment neurotic. He's someone who has been abandoned in the past and so abandons others before they can abandon him. And so what Fanon is pointing to is the way that race becomes an excuse for his psychic structure. And it masks his true psychic structure. And so I think there are these ways that race gets conflated with the psyche, with lack, with desire, and sort of takes us off of our path.
Right. It can be used to sort of negate or the quest for wholeness, and you really get this sense in this book, the quest for wholeness is in and of itself it's so problematic. And a thought I had as I was reading the book was that I wondered, I said, oh, are you arguing at some level that having a split being, of course, we're all split subjects. We don't really get to choose, but this is how it goes. This is what language does to us. But in some ways, I had the sense you were saying that that being a split subject is actually almost like a privilege for African Americans to get to be to see oneself as a split subject. And I guess that goes back to the Shange quote, like it's redundant in the modern world, but from being a split subject, from being barred, from submitting to the law, one also gains access to desire.
Exactly.
Living outside the symbolic is no picnic.
Right. Yes, exactly. And I read race as an effort to suture the split, to get past the split. And that's problematic, right? Because that's inherently, that stands in inherent opposition to the structure of subjectivity. Subjectivity is rooted in lack. But what race aims at is wholeness. So part of the work that part of the thinking I've been doing about race sort of extends Freud's work in the group psychology, where he talks about race as a as connected to the group's identification with some object in the group's in the group's leader that somehow gets seen as the missing object that is in the members of the group. And so that singular object, according to Freud, unifies the group because it's both absent from the group and also within the group. And what I've argued is that that object is what Lacan calls the object A, or the fantasy object. And for me, that fantasy object is race. So race is this fantasy thing that is both missing from you because it's intangible, but also inside of you. And so it's the thing that all members of your race lack, and the thing that you need to unify with the group to get. So race, from a Lacanian perspective, is this pursuit of wholeness. It's an effort to regain that absent thing and make yourself whole. And
versus finding, seeking out other quote-unquote objects, as we use in psychoanalysis, that term, seek out other objects to compensate us for our lack, in a way, is what you're saying, that like race is like a self-immolation, almost like a feeding frenzy upon the self, actually a narcissistic lure, rather yes. than a turning outward to the external world where there might be riches or there right. might be risk.
You can say that desire is rooted in metonymy. Race is rooted in metaphor. With metaphor, there's no movement because you've found the object. So race is about this sort of obsessiveness over the singular thing that will complete me. And so desire loses its natural metonymic proclivity, and it's stuck to this obsessive thing, right? And I think... If you extend that argument, I think things like white supremacy make more sense, right? This sort of obsessiveness, the certainty that it's this singular thing that I need to fix all of my problems, that's where race really becomes problematic. One of the ways that I think about race is in relation to religion. And one of the arguments that the book makes and that I've articulated elsewhere is that race has replaced religion for... You know, religion has historically been very significant to African Americans, and it has given them a sense of identity. But there is a way in which race functions like a new religion. You know, it tells you what is good and what is bad. It tells you what to glorify. It tells you what to worship, right? And we really see that, I think, in the sort of obsessiveness that we've seen in the state capital, right? That sort of, Trump has become like that leader that Freud is talking about. He is the guy. If I follow him, he can make me complete. He can fill my lack. And so I'll do anything for him.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like
filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You say something, actually, or I don't know where it is. I think it might be in the chapter on Ellison, but I was thinking in terms of the Lacanian structure of the sort of the hysteric, you know, the pervert, the psychotic. And you don't use the word hysteric, you use neurotic, actually. Speaking of African-Americans and the relationship to race as one that could become neurotic. But for whites, it's more on, in line with perversion or the pervert. Which made just it clicked. I was like, yeah, absolutely. Because, yeah. You know, on the one hand, the book can be read as an argument to say, okay, you know, for African-Americans, it's time to go beyond ultra race loyalty. It's time, you know, to leave, you know, the talented 10th behind. It's time, you know, to face outward. But at the same time, right, if you have whites are turning more and more toward this use, like this insane, perverse, fetishistic, right, use of black bodies. Can we speak about this? Because I found it really, like, I was like, yes, he's just put his finger on something so important. So
you cut out there for a moment, but I think I got most of what you said.
Okay.
Lacan talks about the structure of desire, and he has this formula for desire. It's the barred S and then the lozenge, that diamond shape thing, and then the A, the object A. And that's the structure of fantasy. So every barred subject experiences their lack, that empty space in the middle, in relation to the fantasy object. But the difference between neurosis and perversion, and I think the model that I'm using is more closer to obsessional neurosis, as I talk about people like Hamlet and so on. But anyway, what happens is that the neurotic is obsessed with the left side, what's happening to the left of that gap, right, which is the barred S. So the neurotic is obsessed with their lack. They feel their lack, and the symbolic reinforces the idea that they are lacking. And that's the kind of structure that I think African Americans are pushed toward. American society says to them that you are lacking. But the difference between African Americans, and in the book I lay out the argument through a discussion of slavery, where slavery is precisely about the notion that African Americans lack and the slave master does not. And the reason you know the slave master does not lack is because the slave master has the slave who actually functions as the object A. But so on the left side, you have this notion of lack that's associated with African Americans. But on the right side, you have the object A. And Lacanian theory talks about perversion as an effort to take on the role of the object A, to take on the role of the object that brings another subject toward a state of jouissance or pleasure. So you become an object for the other's pleasure. And, you know, this is something that Lacan articulates in relation to childhood, for example. You know, the child wants to be the object that the mother desires. The child wants to be the object that fills the mother. And what that means is that the child stands in relation to the mother and not to the father. In Lacanian theory, the father gets associated with the law and with language. And so the child only has a sort of indirect relationship to the law. And I think what you see with whiteness is this sort of indirect relationship to the law. Whiteness invokes a need to maintain the law, but what it really aims at is fill in some sort of illusory emptiness in the system, right? I have to be the object. And again, the white nationalist is perhaps the best example of this. I have to be the object that will make the system whole. The system being the sort of embodied presence of the mother, right? But the mother isn't fully associated with the law, which is why breaking the law isn't a problem. And so I think you in on both sides of this equation, what you have is a struggle to overcome lack. And it plays out in different ways.
Yeah, and if you actually remain merged with the mother, you lose.
Yes.
it doesn't work out. It just doesn't work out very well.
In strict Lacanian terms, you're probably heading for psychosis.
Right. in many terms, different psychoanalytic schools. Yeah, that's the thinking. Let's see, God, I have so many different questions here. Somehow the title of Siddhaya Hartman's book, Lose Your Mother, just came to mind, and how I love that book. And it's sort of the outrageousness of, it fits in somehow with, when I was reading this book, I was like, yeah, like, what is it to face losing your mother? What does one have to gird oneself and to go forth? And just thinking about her journey to Ghana and facing, I will never have access to, you have an argument in the book about history and about the past. And you've read Hartman's work? I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
Some of it. I associate Hartman with the Afro-pessimists, who have a interesting take on race that that I'm challenged to agree with. I struggle to see some of their views.
I mean that's very clear. I was reading you and Hartman and Wilderson more or less, not quite concomitantly, but it's like very, very different argument. But you know, she goes to Ghana and she's looking for the archive. Mm-hmm. In search of an archive that doesn't exist. And in what you're writing, it seems to me you're saying there has to be, we can't descend into melancholy, into a melancholic state to sort of speak outside of Lacanese, you know, but in a sense, I was like, so are you're suggesting that there needs to be a mourning, because in mourning one, then let's go. One lets go of this sort of very traumatic relationship to the past. And yet, right, trauma is like so popular. I mean, you're really up against it, like trying to, you know, because everyone's like, I've been traumatized. The popularization of trauma. And in fact, there's, you know, within psychoanalysis, you know, there's the idea of the international my God, intergenerational to international transmission, the intergenerational transmission of trauma, very popular within the relational school and now being applied, you know, just thinking about slavery, thinking about reparations. I'd really like to ask you about your thoughts about reparations, which maybe we can get to as well. Just I'm on a committee at the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies, the Psychoanalysts Against Racism Committee, and we're having a lot of discussion about a reparations fund. And it's like, you know, in reading your book, I was like, well, so no to reparations? I know it's not that simple. I mean, Hartman comes down no to reparations because I don't want, not wanting to be seen as I think lacking in agency, which is not a term that it's not, in my book, a psychoanalytic term, right? You know, like Baker uses it, Gates uses it, like they're trying to push toward agency. But I'm like, yeah, but what about the unconscious, right? So anyway, where do you have thoughts about how current discussions around reparations, how you see it within the framework that you've put forth in this book? Any thoughts about it?
Well, I would
anything
say
anything you don't want to say.
I would say that it's clear that there's a lasting impact of slavery that's social and that's cultural, and that African Americans have been left behind socially, economically. And so, yes, I think, you know, I think politically, it is something that is necessary. What I struggle with is, what does this mean for how we think about lack? I think, you know, Christina Sharp, who's another one of the Afro-pessimists, talks about wake work and, you know, a mourning that's necessary.
Getting the past into the past. I mean, that's something that she really emphasizes is how can I get this past into the past? Why won't it get into the goddamn past?
Right.
So Winnicottian, if you can't get the past into the past, what a disaster that is.
Right. And from, you know, Lacan says that when you don't mourn, what happens is you leave a gap in the symbolic for the real to emerge out of. So the real is birthed from within this gap in the symbolic. And so you do need a way of closing this gap. But for me, that process shouldn't be obsessive at a personal level. It could be obsessive at a political level, right? Because this isn't changing very quickly. So we need political activity. But I think as individual subjects, we need to separate our political aspirations from any sense that the fantasies pinned upon us somehow define who we are. Fantasies of race, right? So we have to battle the fantasies. And battling that fantasy means political activity, but it also means not giving into it on a personal level. And again, I would say this is one of the things that I find problematic in, you know, some of the Afro-pessimists' writings that I've seen. Wilderson's, you mentioned Wilderson, his most recent book titled Afro-Pessimism.
He's very overt, right? He's very clear that he's coming out of a psychotic break.
Right, right.
And he begins, I mean, it's not like a secret. He begins the book there, and And in thinking about your argument, if there's only sort of the, I don't know, I'm going to screw this up. I was going to say, if it's only the real and the symbolic, but there's a collapse that he cleaves to. There's a comfort in a collapse where there could be, for lack of a better, there could be space, there could be an acceptance of limit, there could be a grappling with limit. There's a limit. There's a limitlessness to the Afro-pessimistic position, right? In that it is the lowest of black is the lowest of the low, the bottom of the bottom. It's one note.
Yeah. It's one I'm not an analyst, so I don't want to analyze Wilderson, but I'll say something about the book. You know, I'm a literary critic, so I'll talk about, you know, the book itself. And I think one of the things that I see in the book is this effort to define Afro-pessimism as what he calls a meta theory, which is interesting because then, you know, it becomes a theory about theory. And so there, I wonder to what extent we have that same resignification that I've been talking about. And the resignification seems tied to the concept of blackness, which the text says is distinct from and shouldn't be collapsed with any other notion of otherness. And, you know, they're drawing on work that I draw on, Hortense Spiller's work, for example, and Orlando Patterson's work. Patterson talks about the ways that the slave is alienated. My difference with Afro-pessimism, one of my differences would be that I see the effort to alienate the slave as an effort, not as something that is always successful. And then the next step that Afro-pessimism makes is to read blacks as slaves, which, yeah, what does that mean, right? What are the implications of that? What sort of temporal relationship gets collapsed there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also the lure of essence. Like, you can feel there's a, you know, and whenever the lure of essence comes in, and it's not strategic. You know, like, I like, you know, like, fuss and, like, we're thinking about strategic essentialism. I always was like, yeah, that, I get that. But I guess the strategy, it's interesting, the strategy is to claim the most abject status as fixed.
Right. And which is really strange, right? Because on the one hand, the argument is that what slavery has done, And again, this is coming from Spiller's in part, is it's transformed personality into commodity, right? That's a phrase from one of Spiller's essays. So there's this transformation, this objectification of personality into slavehood. So then what does it mean for a theorist to assert that African Americans exist perpetually in this condition? You know, one of the collection that Derek and I are working on has an essay by Jennifer Friedlander that engages my work and some other Black scholars' work. And she poses the question, how do we deal with fantasy? I think it's a really smart question because, to go back to what I was saying about Afro-pessimism as a meta theory, the urgency within the theory is to see itself as capable of seeing past theory, seeing reality for what it is. The Afro-pessimist is woke. The Afro-pessimist sees race for what it really is, right? And I, at some level, that means for the Afro-pessimists, seeing race as a fantasy. But then if you recognize that this is a fantasy, then what do you do next, right? Do you try to dismantle the fantasy or do you try to operate from the perspective of race in all cases? I think the effort in Afro-pessimism is to cling to race, whereas the effort in my work is to get past race.
Well, let's talk about your chapter on Beloved, which was a delight. I was like, "Oof, you really?" we watch, Setha move and move deeper and deeper into fantasy, into psychosis, merge with a ghost, controlled by a ghost. A patient comes in and tells me that, the television is speaking about her. That's Setha. That's Setha. I mean, that's when I read that book, I was like, oh, this is a descent into psychosis. I mean, it's actually Morrison's second descent into psychosis. She does leave, in The Bluest Eye, she leaves Piccola in psychosis. But in Beloved, we see the transformation, the move from a psychotic life to another life, a life outside of psychosis. I just loved what you did. And I don't know, I just wanted to say that to you. And the students loved it.
Yes, so you've mentioned that you've been teaching this stuff, which is really strange.
That's right.
But I think that chapter sort of brings together a lot of what I've been saying, because what we see in the figure of Beloved, there's that moment in the novel where Setha, Denver, and Beloved are all talking, and it's unclear who's talking. And there's this moment where Setha talks about losing her mother, where Beloved talks about losing Setha, and she says, "I've lost her three times." And the first time that she loses her is when the people with no skin, implying white people, we're meant to assume, steal her from her mother, and there's gun smoke all around. And so the sense is that the first time that she loses Setha, right, who is living in times of slavery, is years before when Beloved is in Africa. Now we know that Setha's biological daughter isn't from Africa, right? Setha was born in America. So what Beloved represents is the embodied trauma of what Morrison's epigraph calls 60 million or more. She represents the embodied trauma of the slave. And what Setha does is open herself up to that trauma. At the end of that section, when the three of them are all talking, all of them say, "She is mine, she is mine." So it's this process of claiming the other, claiming this traumatic past that opens up Setha to a trauma. Yeah. So that's one way that Morrison is thinking about trauma. That's connected to my argument that race itself opens you up to trauma. But Morrison is also talking about trauma as a haunting that you just walk into. Setha talks about her rememory when you bump into a memory that belongs to someone else. I think there you have a model of racism as bringing you back to the past. So both race and racism, adherence to race and practices of racism, bring you back to the traumatic past. And what it does for Setha is it really destroys her sense of self. And so what we see in the final pages of the text is Paul D imposing an identity on her. And he says to her, "You, your own best thing, Setha, you." And when he says that, "you," she replies with a question, "me?"
Me?
Right? It's like an accusation that he's posing upon her, but it allows her to claim an identity that is separate from the past. And so I think that's the kind of movement that we need at an individual level.
And Denver is like watching what Denver does. Denver says, Denver's like, okay, my mother's not, she's choosing this over me, this over me. I mean, Denver's a very painful character, like to be in, and to watch her. And she has to move herself out into the world to get other things she needs in this life.
She's a very heroic character too. Right. She is the character who is constructing a path toward her own desire on her own. And so I think both of these characters, Setha and Denver, represent the individual work that African Americans have to do within the larger context of the political work that has to be done in opposition to racism. They're two separate levels that get conflated in a problematic way, most typically, but not in Morrison's work.
Well, we're almost at 50 minutes. We are. The session's over. We'll have to stop here for today. We do have to stop because I don't want to. This is terrific, and there's a million more things to talk about. But, you know, we have some rules and regulations around here that we try to abide by, you know, so nobody goes crazy. Thank you for taking the time. And I'm going to be very much so looking forward to your new publication. When do you expect it to come out, more or less?
It's at the presses right now. It's at Rutledge. It's in production, and it should be out in the summer.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Maybe we'll be out in the summer. Who knows? Or maybe we'll just be in the house reading books. Yeah, walking the floor over it, right. So, okay, well, that's really exciting. And I look forward to teaching you again. And maybe I'll send you my syllabus. This one is this is different. I'm not just teaching as I taught before, which was your book and Fakhri David's Internal Racism. And for the listeners, I believe that Fakhri and I will be talking probably in the next month or so about his book Internal Racism. So, the students are, you know, we're going to have a whole new group of students, and we're going to work our way through chapters of your book, not the whole book this time, but I told them they have to buy it, you know, you got to buy this book.
That's great.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd love to see both syllabi and get a sense of how they're responding to it.
I mean, the book really, this book moved this last class. I thought it moved people. And there was only one person really was, quote unquote, the local, you know, Lacanian expert. But it took people places emotionally that a lot of Lacanian work can leave the same crew cold. Actually, your book took people places, and so they got in touch with sort of feelings, structures of feeling. So that doesn't happen often in the book of sort of, you know, theory and literary theory.
That's great. So chapeau. You know, yeah, that's great. I'm writing for multiple audiences, and so it has to ring true for Lacanians as well as people interested in race. So it's great to hear that it translates well.
Absolutely. Sort of like in the way that Mari Rudy or somebody, it's like you're a little less user-friendly than she is, but you're, it translated and people just went with it. And the class, just people who did not know anything, they were like, oh yeah, this Lacan stuff seems pretty important to, you know, connect to race. So yeah. All right. Well, listen, a delight. I don't know when the interview will be up, but I'll send you, I'll be in touch with an email or something. And I guess that's all for now. Actually, I'm going to stop recording and then you and I can just say goodbye in person.
Okay. Excellent.